Okay.
Blog Talk Radio.
Tribe Family Channel, and you can almost hear the drum beats of the ancestors. I am Beverly Black, and you are on the Book Club Hub Book Tour as we continue live on Tribe Family Channel. The Book Club Hub Book Tour continues with Geraldine Hollis, a civil rights activist, and Bernard N. Lee, also an activist, both known in their own right for breaking barriers for Black folk in the days when it was unheard of to speak up against Jim Crow. But because of two people like this, we are here now. And so, without further ado, you are on the Book Club Hub Book Tour. We invite you to tune in for industry insights, author readings, free book giveaways, and industry professional connections waiting for you to make the magic happen, because everyone has a story to tell. Book club reviewers, artists, editors, authors, and marketing professionals will grace the mic all season long for this annual book tour special. And this is our first season. The Book Club Hub is comprised of 60 book clubs. There will be no less than 160 live on-air readings at the conclusion of this six-month book tour. Now, I want to honor those that have already come on the book club tour before us. I appeared on the first inaugural show in January, along with Pastor Tony Gatlin and sisters Ramel Lee and Wanda Burnside. Following that was Diane Sears and Michelle Berard. Bringing up February, we had J. Elliott Howard, Ray Mitchell, and Cecilia Carey. Actually, Cecilia Carey couldn't make it. We're going to reschedule her. So now we are with Mrs. Geraldine Hollis. She is going to tell us all about her and her publications, how she got started on her journey, what she has done to become a civil rights activist and iconic figure, recently notably inducted in the Mississippi African American Museum. There is just so much to tell about this iconic woman. And she also has her own show here on Tribe Family Channel, Voices of Wisdom. March 1st, 8 of the remaining Tougaloo 9 will grace the mic. That show will be moderated by Mr. Mike O'Brien to afford Mrs. Geraldine Hollis to guest. Also, Mr. Bernard N. Lee grew up in the military, broke barriers where the educational system was segregated. So we have one on the library side breaking barriers and one in the educational system breaking barriers. They're here to tell us their own story. So welcome, Mrs. Geraldine Hollis, and welcome, Mr. Bernard N. Lee, to the Book Club Hub. How are you this evening?
Hello.
We're fine.
Great to be here.
I'm fine. Thank you.
It is great to have both of you here. And I'm not sure if you've ever met each other on any other show, but now you know a little bit about what the show entails. So we're going to start with ladies first, but we're going to go in a roundtable fashion. So we'll toggle back and forth between the two guests, and we invite our listeners to call 347-539-5285 if you'd like to ask a question or pose a comment. I know a lot of people listen through their computer, and we appreciate all of the archived listeners that will tune in after the show through the link. You can follow our studio at blogtalkradio.com/Gumbo for the Soul. We are brought to you by Gumbo for the Soul International. Mrs. Geraldine Hollis, you are notably one of the Tougaloo 9. Your journey began as one of the Tougaloo 9, being trained and mentored by the late, great Medgar Evers. In 1961, an iconic event took place in history. Please take us back to that time, which led to your penning of your book, Back to Mississippi.
Thank you so much, Ms. Beverly. And as usual, I appreciate the opportunity to share my story. And even before I share my story, I just want to let you know that I got an email from the director of the library in Jackson, Mississippi on yesterday. And she was letting me know how awesome our story is right there in the Civil Rights Museum. The people that had turned out for the Mississippi Museum, they thought that they would have $180,000 for the year. Right now, there has been almost 300,000 people.
Wow.
And one of the reasons is because Mississippi has become open. They are showing the rawness of what happened in Mississippi as well as the healing. And I'm just happy to say that I don't want to get off of the question too much, but that has been my goal, is to share the fact that we have to stand up for our rights. Sometimes we have to struggle, sometimes we have to fight, and sometimes we just have to have some ingenuity. And I do believe that that's what happened on March 27, 1961, when going into a white-only library, a public library, was a no-no. But you see, we were dealing with segregation in all of the public facilities. But because this was an institution that probably that they had not thought about, I don't think they were well prepared for what happened on their doorsteps that particular day. For 9 African-American students to enter into that library and be told that we could not be there, that we didn't belong there. But you see, we had already made our case. We had studied. We had participated and practiced on the techniques and the strategies needed in order for us to be successful. Under the guidance of Meg Evers and the Dr. Mangrum, who was at the college there, and the students who were a part of the Jackson NAACP, not sure just who was who right now, but some of them were before we all joined. So we made a plan. And so this is what I share when I'm talking with young people. Make a plan. Have a plan. Know what you want to accomplish. And our goal was to go into that library and read that book that we had chosen, because we planned to go to the library that was dedicated to the colored section of the community and to ask for a book that we could not find there. Doing our research, and it wasn't online then, doing our research to find just such a book that we knew would not be into that particular library because it wasn't up to the same standards with the kind of materials. And so when we went into that library and found out we couldn't find that book there, so we moved on to the next part of our plan, which was to go to the white-only library. And so we went into that library, and when we got there, we went to all of the places that we needed to go. But you see, we had people watching, and they were very adamant that we were not supposed to be there. But we went in, and we went to the card catalog, we went to the stacks of the books, and I remember, and also it's documented, that I went to the counter, and I shared with a young lady there that I came to find a particular book. And she did not want to wait on me. She told me that I should not be in there, that I was in the wrong place, and that I didn't belong in that public paid facility, that I had no right to be there. That in itself let me know that I needed to be there, because all of us had to pay taxes, and that was a tax-paying facility.
Mm-hmm.
So we went back to our seats, each one of us, finding a book, and seated ourselves in that library and proceeded also to read those books or to look at them, because reading was the goal. Go into that library and to read a book. Now, it was during that time that we found inside of that library, not just patrons, but also we found people who were either the FBI or the sheriffs or some of the police detectives. They became all around us and surrounded us in many ways in that library, and continued to speak to us and let us know that we didn't belong there. So we had already in place called ABC, CBS, and NBC.
Mm.
Getting UPI interested in knowing, because, you see, we had some guardians. We knew that if we had gone into that library without any acknowledgement from people that could have sheltered us, we would have ended up with the same kind of things that many others had, where you have brutality and injury and explicit words and all of those things. So we tried to make sure that we worked our plan so that even if those things came up, that we were going to be nonviolent. Our goals was to not retaliate in a physical way, not by word and not by deed, so that our successful intervention would make a difference. So that was the case for going into the library, and that was just an introduction on why we went to the library.
Wow, wow.
But I want all of you to know that this wasn't an easy task, and it wasn't done by just the nine of us. There were about 15 or more young people that went out that day. And some of those young people were watching behind the vehicles, keeping an eye on us. There was the driver and the photographer who was taking some pictures. And there was those who kept a tab on certain parts of our activities so that they could share those by telephone call or going. And at that time, we had to go to a telephone booth. But they kept a watch out to see what was happening. So it was a whole process. It wasn't something that we jumped up and did. It was a process that had some planning. And I didn't want to bring books in right now, but when I looked back and I wrote my second book, March Memories, I tried to remember and pull together some of the reasons why and what happened on a daily, day-by-day process for us to make those decisions to go into that library, the physical, the emotional, all of these things that had to do with planning and making this plan. And so
right.
this was one of the reasons why I came back and pulled that book in, because I
wanted
to share how processes go and how planning can make a difference. So this is how we got into the library, and at that time everything was segregated. The schools were segregated. There has been a constitutional law that the schools should be integrated, and so we wanted to make sure that we let them know that we knew that some things need to change. So our goal was to go into that public library, and because it was educational, and because we were in educational institution, Tougaloo College, in Tougaloo.
Indeed, 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 and thank you so much for setting up the tone for your publications, Back to Mississippi, and then the other memoir, We'll let you give us the title again and talk about that in just a bit. We will hear, excuse me, from Mr. Bernard Lee as well. But I wanted to just note that in that planning, I can just foresee, and thank you for so eloquently describing and taking us back to that time, but I could just imagine the type of planning for those days. You're talking about making a civil rights stance against a segregated system that is playing across the landscape of America, and we are in the Jim Crow era. So the first plan is to stay alive. I can just imagine the type of stealth planning and covert operation that it had to take to pull this off, and the type of mentoring that Mr. The late great Megger Evers had to evoke and instill in all of you so that you successfully made your point, this profound statement that you belong here, a change will be made, this is the fork in the road, and to really look at the white supremacist face of America's library system and say it's over. You basically put the white supremacist society on notice that this is the confrontation and we are not provoking violence. So let's pin that. We're going to come back to your journey and in terms of what led to writing the book, now that it's prefaced with the pivotal act in our civil rights history that led to, it's basically your journey. You were here. You are here. This is the purpose. Reason that you are here. I have to believe that because you've made such an impact in society. Mr. Bernard Lee, I will give you the opportunity to not only have some comments about Mrs. Geraldine Hollis's story as one of the Tougaloo Nine, but also to first tell us about your story, the impact that you made in Black history in terms of helping to desegregate the school systems. And, of course, this led to your writings. So go ahead and tell us your story of activism.
Well, thank you, Ms. Black, for giving me a chance to share my stories with your audience. And thank you, Ms. Hollis, for so eloquently sharing what you had to endure so that those of us today could have a better life and be recognized as full citizens. I am the son of a military family. My dad was in the U.S. Army. He entered the Army at 15 years old. His mother and father were deceased by the time he was five. So he was very independent, and during the course of time, 27 plus years in the military, my sisters and my brother and I traveled with him around this country and in Europe. So my journey into activism began in Georgia in 1955. We were living on post, and because we were military kids, our life was a little bit different than the kids that we call the kids who were in town. On post, you were treated equal based upon your mother or father's rank, based upon where you lived, your quarters on post, and based upon the military rules and regulations. And so we were all military kids, and we looked at each other as military kids, and we didn't have as many skirmishes as there might be between kids who did not believe they shared the same background or were equal. That, however, didn't shield us from what occurs when you leave the military post and go into the army. So let me paint a picture for you. Let me paint a picture for you on post. We lived in a 4-unit barracks. We lived on the upstairs on the right. Just below us was an Italian family. Upstairs on our other side was an Irish family. Downstairs on the front of the building was a Filipino family.
Wow.
We were all military kids, and we all played together, and we believed that everything was going to be the same for us until it was time to go to school. This was 1955 in Georgia, Augusta, Georgia. And my sister and I went to the bus stop. We waited to get on the bus, and then a fellow looked at us and said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, you know, we're here to go to school with everybody. You know, we're waiting for the bus." And he said, "Well, your bus is on that corner over there. And by the way, it's just leaving." So my sister and I had to run to catch the bus.
Mm.
We caught the bus. We left the post. We went across town. We went out into the farmland. We went through cornfields, through cotton fields, till we got to this huge clearing. And in this huge clearing was this gray, big, brand new, beautiful school, larger and more beautiful than any school I have ever seen.
Mm.
That was our school in Augusta, Georgia in 1955. We got back on the bus at the end of the day. We came back to the post. We got our bus stopped at one corner. Our friend's bus stopped at another corner. All the kids got off the bus. We ran toward each other, locked arms, and shared the things that we had seen and heard during our day.
Wow.
That was my introduction to Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
You can expound. We have time.
Yes. So we lived in Georgia, and you know, military kids move. We move at least every 3 years. So we moved, we left Georgia, and in sixth grade I went to school in Texas. Halfway through that school year, we moved to Oklahoma. I went to school at Douglas Middle and High School, which was in the African-American section of town. And it had a elementary school, middle school, and a high school all in one complex.
Wow. Wow. That's the schoolhouse.
That was. Now, what we didn't have, we did not have a playground except for the one for the small kids. We did not have an athletic field. We played pickup football in the parking lot. We did not have a paved parking lot. We had mud and cinders. We played pickup football anyway. Our football team didn't have a field, so they practiced on the interstate because the interstates were building these great big turnoffs, roundabouts, and they put this nice plush grass at the intersections for all those turnoffs. And so the team practiced at the intersection. You'd have a left end who'd be 4 feet below the right end because the intersections were slanted, so the water would run off. It was an interesting time to practice football.
To improvise like that is just like astounding. But go on, continue.
We had to improvise because we had no facilities. That was separate and that's what separate and unequal looked like. However, the teachers were top notch. They cared about the students. They gave 115% every day. And I got a fairly good education for the time that I spent there in the sixth grade. When it was time to go to the seventh grade, something very different occurred in Lawton, Oklahoma. The military had been ordered to desegregate, and that meant that the students who attended school had to attend school with all of the other students in the town and not in separate facilities. So the military met with the townspeople, the Board of Education, and they came to an arrangement. So I was one of the first students to go to the Lawton Central Junior High School, which was the middle school in Lawton, Oklahoma. In order to sweeten that deal, the military agreed to help fund the building of a brand new high school. So there was Lawton Senior High School, which had to integrate, and then there was this brand new high school called Eisenhower High School. They determined there were two gates. You went into gate one or gate two to get on the post, and there were these long thoroughfares that came out of town into the post. Everyone on the west side of gate one, that long thoroughfare that went all the way from the post all the way out of town, everyone on the west side was Eisenhower. Everyone on the east side went to Lawton High School.
Wow, so this is the first districting, segmenting by district. Let me just say it like that. This is the first point of history in sectioning school districts.
That's right. In Lawton, Oklahoma, they had one high school for Caucasian kids, one high school for African Americans. They were in a different section of town, although they were only about three quarters of a mile apart. However, when the military requested the integration, the town had to make a choice. At that time, each student came with about $525 per student. I believe that the kids from Post made up anywhere from a third to 45% of the student body for the high school. So that was a lot of money.
Wow. Wow.
So the town had to decide, do we take the money and do we accept the offer to build this new high school with help? And when they made that decision, instead of arguing about the students who were allowed to opt in from Douglas, if you went to Douglas, you could choose to go to Lawton High School. You could, because Douglas was on the east side. So you could choose to go to Lawton High School, or, as some friends of mine did, you could stay at Douglas all the way through high school. The rivalry, instead of people saying you don't belong here, the rivalry existed going forward between Lawton High School and Eisenhower.
Wow.
It was either Lawton or Eisenhower. So, yes, you did belong, because you played on the football team, you played on the basketball team, you ran track, you sang in the choir, and as a result, you were a Lawton High School student, and we were very proud of all your accomplishments, especially when you defeated Eisenhower.
Right, right. Wow. That is extraordinary. Now, I do want to give each of you the opportunity to acknowledge each other's story before we move into the phase where I ask you about your writing journey and the title of your book. So if Mr. Bernard, if you would like to comment about anything that Mrs. Geraldine Hollis has said, you may go ahead, and then Mrs. Geraldine Hollis, you may go ahead after him.
Yes, I do. I'm so proud of what you did. It took a lot of courage to do that. My wife is from Greensboro, North Carolina, and she sat in Greensboro, North Carolina, and went to jail. Her father was a principal. So I know from her story how much courage it took to march, to be arrested, to have to go to jail, and to be very proud that we did that together. She with her classmates and classmates from Bennett, which is in Greensboro, and from A&T, which is in Greensboro. They did that together. And you mentioned Tougaloo. That's great, a historically black college. And the fact that you took an interest in what was going on in town and you pushed things forward, really very proud of you. Proud to know you.
Yes. Ms. Geraldine Hollis is one of the famous Tougaloo Nine. She is one of the famous Tougaloo Nine. Mrs. Geraldine Hollis, you have the floor.
Okay. I would just like to say thank you to Mr. Bernard and Lee for your experiences. And it's always traumatic when you go through some things where you feel comfortable and then you get the rug pulled from underneath you, and you find out that things are really different. And that can be very damaging, and I'm sure that you were able to overcome that, and I'm glad that you were writing your story. I have written your story about that because so many people don't know these things. It's really amazing that people think that things have always been the same way they are now, and they don't realize the situations and circumstances that so many of us had to go through in order to achieve and get to the places where we are. Thank you for acknowledging the historical black colleges and universities, because that is one of the greatest successes in the black in the South, really, that we did have colleges that were afforded to us. And most of them were land-grant colleges or Christian schools that turned into colleges and really have been nurturing over the years. I certainly hope that so many people even now could get a chance to go to some of the historical black colleges, especially coming from places where they've never experienced a minority of education in or around African-American people. They find that it is really a different walk. Very different from some of the other colleges and universities. So back to your story, living on post, I can understand, I can really understand that. I was a military kid. I didn't live on the post, but I remember living in some of the spaces that were provided for the families, young families, for those who participated in World War II. And my dad moved us for a short period of time, and we lived in some of those. They weren't barracks, but they were the homes, similar to some of the, the mini homes, the small homes that they have now. It had just one kitchen and a bedroom on one side and a bedroom on the other. And there was a central bathroom, shower, and all of that in the middle of this complex. So you had to leave your house or your home in order to go and wash or to the shower or bathe or use the restroom. So we experienced that. And
wow.
Then I came through, and my adopted parents were both military. And they didn't have any children. They just had me when they adopted me and my granddaughter. But I heard their stories also. You were, in a way, it was a blessing that you did go to a school that was a brand new school. And I know that there are so many things that has the differences in segregation and integration. Sometimes we get rewarded for some things, but on the other hand, we have so much that we are denied. And those things we don't really realize, they make a difference in our lives. They either hurt us or they help us to be able to be stronger. And I can see that you have moved forward and that you seem to be very stronger in your understanding and outreach for life. And I just want to commend you on being able to overcome those challenges that you lived with.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you
yes.
both for the dialogue and knowing that you have synergy as civil rights activists and having come through an era in which I have to tell you both, thank you so very much, because had it not been for the challenges that you pressed through, we wouldn't be where we are today. So I want to say thank both of you. Now, let's bring up the book that were birthed out of a movement in which you were thrust in involuntarily by sheer virtue of being on this planet at this time. Mrs. Geraldine Hollis, your book, Back to Mississippi. What spawned
yes.
your writing? We know that you went through the struggle back in Mississippi when the library system was segregated. What spawned your writing this first book? How did that journey begin?
Okay, thank you.
Or were you always a writer?
I was a reader. always a reader. But I would say that I documented, I found myself journaling as a child, not as a real child, but as a young lady. And when I went into college, I did journaling. I saw things that I wanted to document, I wanted to remember. And those things had made me want to make some notations to see what was going on and how I could look at this, and even to be able to, I didn't know that it was journaling at the time. I was just really writing down things. So I'm so happy that I did make these notations and these journal notations. It was in 1961 that we had the event. And my college education was really okay. I was always on a fast pace in high school and college. And I did get arrested. All of us got arrested. We had some problems with that. They wanted to have us expelled from school, but our president prevailed on that, and he would not expel us. And someone donated the amounts of monies that we needed to pay for our fine. And we all had lawyers that would help us to overcome this. However, I never really got over the situation of doing this, walking into this library and making a difference. Because when I got out of school at after 3 years and three summers with a major and two minors and had prepared myself for working in that area, I found that I couldn't find a job in my field. In fact, I couldn't find pretty much not a teaching job in the vicinity that I could travel back and forth with easily. And we lived right there on the border where Mississippi and Louisiana touched, right there with the Mississippi River. And so it was at that time that I sent out all kinds of letters and things, or resumes, to see if I could get a job in that area. And that did not happen for me. So just although coming out of school early, I had to find a way to do something for myself. So I started making classes for students at the community center, and I taught them for about 6 months there. And then when I wrote my resume a little bit later after that, I included dance on there. And so I was able to get a job away from home, and it was all the way across the state to Meridian. And at that time, I got a job, and it was because I had mathematics, biology, physical education, and dance. And those things, I do believe, helped me to get that job, because otherwise, just to say that I'm a teacher and I'm fully qualified, I have taken my my teacher's exam and all of those things, just having everything that I needed, I still did not get a job or a call for a job. So
you had to actually have a curriculum.
Oh yeah,
basically that's basically what. Rather than saying, okay, I'm available, and sorry to cut in and interject, but that's what it sounds like to me, that you basically put together a packaged curriculum, and then they saw. In that, do you feel by any reason that perhaps because of the sit-in, maybe you had been blackballed in that area at all,
That's what I'm thinking, and my brothers and all, we feel that way, that because my name was out there in those areas, that they did not respond to my resumes.
Right.
I put on there that I had those other degrees, or not so much degrees, but all of the subjects that I was able to be qualified for. But it did not, it didn't garner any attention. And I know that there were being teachers hired in the area, but no one responded to me. So I sort of felt that, and that's why I moved forward and tried to do some things to help myself. And when I did send the next ones out, I included the dance on there to show that I had much more than just the subjects or the subject matter that they probably needed, or something that they really could use, because there wasn't a lot of dance majors at that time or people that had experiences. So that helped me, and that's what I was told when I did go for that interview, that the dance and all of the other things that I was capable of made a difference. But it took a while, and it was away from my area where I lived, and so I think that that made a difference. But, yeah, I think they call it blackballing now.
Indeed, so, indeed.
I felt like that was the case. So
okay.
Yeah, that's what I had to endure. One of the other things, though, we as a Tuvalu group, all of us had some challenges. All of us had challenges, and that's what we're still dealing with and talking with. And so many, quite a few did not finish college at Tuvalu. They had families that were had problems with the families, and people trying to do things to the families. And so many left Tuvalu, several of them. Three of us, I believe, graduated from Tuvalu, and that meant that the others did not, more than likely. I'm not sure just how many, because a couple of, one at least I know, came back and did finish. So, but at that time, not all of us finished on time from Tuvalu.
So basically, after the sit-in, there were death threats, and there may not have been an uprise of violence, but there was definitely this covert operation to blackball and prevent progress for any of you to continue your education without having it become a very cumbersome struggle within a struggle. So that's completely understandable. So you were journaling and chronicling your experience and leading up to your penning the book?
Yes, but that took a while. In 2006, that was the 45th year, and I had made a complete teaching career and counseling and all of the other things that I was a part of for those years, and I never really mentioned what I did.
Wow.
Because of what had happened in Mississippi, I just sort of did the best job that I could, and I worked very hard and got myself involved in all kinds of things to help people. And so
wait,
I knew what I wanted to do.
let me interrupt you. So now, I'm sorry. Let me interrupt you because I hear different things. So basically, you sequestered yourself as far as the history and the impact that you had made desegregating the library systems because you had been blackballed so that you could have a successful teaching career. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, that's
wow.
It. I didn't divulge that fact that I was a part of the Tugu Nine for all of those years. I told my husband, and I very seldom would mention that to anyone.
Wow.
It was in 2006 when I was invited to come together with the Tugulu Nine, and we went in at that time, and all of us had the same question. Why wasn't the Tugulu Nine acknowledged for what we had done? And so we said we were going to sort of look into that and work on it, although at that time we were really uplifted because the city of Jackson gave us a key to the city, two keys to the city, and all kinds of accolades for that particular time. But that was only because the city council and some of the people who were from Tugu had gotten together and they wanted to bring this together. So we checked with each other and we just kept saying, well, we should have been acknowledged. And I think that most of us had that feeling that we had not, because what we were seeing was that all of the other things that had happened with violence, all of the violence was acknowledged. The Freedom Riders and everything else that came through Mississippi was highly acknowledged. And by that time, they were even making movies or all kinds of things on the violence that had happened. But we were saying, no, what we did was very important because we opened up the state of Mississippi in an educational platform that people just did not know or acknowledge, and we wanted to know why something had not been done. Because we know that there was news articles on it at the time, but nobody really wanted to come out and sort of acknowledge it. And so go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say, and then, too, like you said, they were noting the violence, of course, that always makes the mainstream news. So when you have something that was successful, planned, peaceful, and it made an impact, just like today, you don't hear good news when it comes to our black folk. Now, let me let Bernard jump in here and give us a little post-history leading up to his writing so that we can keep this conversation balanced, and then we're going to get back to, but I'll let you because I interrupted, I'll let you go ahead and finish your point and the comments, take your time, and then we're going to toggle back and forth, so we'll let Bernard jump in when you finish your comments to this part.
Okay, I just wanted to let you know that it was 2011 when we had our 50th reunion. By that time, I had started writing between 2007 and 2011, and that was the time that I broke the ice and came back to that particular event with my book in my hand. And that in itself is another story.
I can understand how it could take 40-something years. I just recently started a radio show addressing something that happened in my past as a teenager, and that had been 41 years. So I can understand that there's a process and an unfolding. There's some shock, some post-traumatic you know, stress afterwards, because you have to endure the impact of being ostracized from society in a era when you strove to become a teacher and an educator, but however, having to keep what impacted your life in that sense pretty much under wraps. So when you're sending out resumes or you're going after opportunities, you're hoping that it doesn't come up because it has been publicized and it may not have been highly publicized, but it doesn't mean that even word of mouth, because, you know, you're in a Jim Crow era. Now, so fast forward to 2006, 2007, and then ultimately 2011, which was just 7 short years ago. Just 7 short years ago, to say that the journey began in 1961 and then pretty much in 2011,
years.
That would be, yeah. Well,
50 years.
And then I know the anniversary is coming up here. You're going to have a special show and a special honor to Mr. Megar Evers on some upcoming shows for Voices of Wisdom. So now, Mr. Bernard Lee, we're going to give you the opportunity to jump in. And the same thing, give us a little dialogue about after, you know, the districting, if that's a word, if you will, of the school systems and how, you know, everyone favored. Give us some post history on that. And then we're going to do a station identification break and come to the point of your actual book titles.
Okay, thank you. We were able to merge the three schools, the students from the three schools, and the town did just fine. The students from Douglas had a choice to go to the high school, Lawton Senior High, and the students who were on the west side of that avenue were able to go to the new high school. And I did not stay very long after my time in the seventh grade. That year, we moved to Germany. So in 1958, I went to school in Germany in a one-room schoolhouse. My sister was in the seventh grade. I was in the eighth grade. In 1959, 60, and 61, I attended Nuremberg High School in Nuremberg, Germany, where they held the huge parades before World War II. And then I came back to Lawton in my dad's rotation, and I attended Lawton High School. And I intend to go to a reunion at Lawton High School in April. I have been invited back as a graduate of that school. I attended Cameron College, which is now a university, which is in the town of Lawton, and I attended Howard University in Washington, D.C. During that entire time, I was learning and growing and becoming a person who had so many experiences with so many different types of people and places that it really served me well. And so I, like Ms. Hollis, wrote a book, and this one took me 32 years to complete. So
wow.
I understand. Yes, I understand. I began in 1982. I wrote 56 pages. I stopped, and I did not take it up again for 32 years. I completed that book in 2014, and I completed my second book in 2017.
Wow.
So my second book takes me through the 3 years that we were in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
I learned to speak German, enough German to not have to take any foreign language in college. So
you did not have to take any foreign language in college because you learned to speak German.
Yes, I took a test.
Wow.
And if you were able to master the test, the language test, you opted out of language in college, and I was able to master the German language test. Sprechen Sie Deutsch.
Sprechen Sie
Deutsch. That is amazing.
I learned so much. I learned that Americans were envied in the rest of the world. We were envied for all the things that we were able to do and we were free to do. I also learned that African Americans were not discriminated against as a standard in Germany. In fact, there was a curiosity about people of color, but there were not laws in place to discriminate against us. And so we were able to come and go to interact with the local people, and the military tried very hard to be good citizens, to be good neighbors. They gave open houses. They gave away prizes during holidays. They were able to get the local people to participate in activities that the Americans would set up. And I was all a part of that and just a military kid. I wasn't a black kid or a different kid. I was just a military kid. So that was a good experience during my teen years. And that's what's in that book.
Wow, wow. And the diversity, the experience of just the diversity in traveling and being immersed in different languages and different cultures and being able to continue on and have that apply to your higher learning is amazing. Now, did either of you have a comment for each other before we go to station identification and talk about the exact titles of your books and have you read an excerpt? Would either of you like to comment to each other?
I'd like to compliment Ms. Willis for the work that she did in Back to Mississippi, in journaling that, and in ultimately writing it. I think she realized that if she did not tell a story and share it with others, the story might not get told. So congratulations for that effort. And being a reader expands your mind. Being a journaler helps you remember your past. And being a writer shares all of that richness with your readers. Congratulations.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. I appreciate that. All of that's right on target. And I would just like to say that it's great to reveal a book where you've lived a lot of these things and to be able to open up not only your eyes but other people's eyes. And I say that because for me, just to open up myself, it was really hard. It was really hard for me. And I can see why none of the others have written a book, because it just takes a lot out of you. It's very emotional to go back through all of those things, even when I'm talking to groups, which I do a lot now. And each time it's an emotional high or even a very emotional low, depending. And I'm learning to move through that. And it just makes me stronger as I speak to people, because I know that if I don't tell them about it, they won't really know it. And as much as I speak, there are so many people that have not heard about what is going on, except in one case. I got the fact, and I shared that earlier, that our story and my book and our story is one of the highlights in the Mississippi Civil Rights Museum. And because I'm so glad that I was able to write it and to put it out there for myself and my colleagues and for the state of Mississippi.
Amen, amen. Well, we want to thank you both, and we're going to listen to a song called Unite, and we're going to come right back.
Okay.
workers of the world, unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains. Karl Marx, Communist Manifesto.
Yeah.
Spirit of Kosatu, Congress of South African Trade Union, World Federation of Trade Unions, South African Communist Party, South African South Central. What up, Jubilee Shine? Tracks a million on the beat. Rendezvous. Yeah. We move in silence like telepathy. Holy organized and finna set us free. Flipping the trajectory. Bring about that change, most definitely. Didn't shoot the sheriff, and I didn't shoot the deputy. Didn't reach for no waistband, had my hands up. Didn't hang myself in no jail cell, Sandra. Didn't point no gun at the officer, Kareem Gaines. Said the goon squad, they wasn't trying to apprehend her. Holla if you hear me, it's been 500 years plus. Ready for that black nation flag to be raised up. Sovereign, tolerant, death to ruling classes. Threatened cause they know this microphone kills fascists. Black woman strong, yeah, black woman beautiful. Black woman rise to the top cause she beautiful, yeah. Love them, feed them, lead them to freedom like Harriet. Then run them red lights with the global proletariat, Organize and rise, decolonize them lies. We qualified to ride, we working class unite. We move in silence like telepathy. My real freedom fighters on the highest frequency. Nothing to lose but the chains, but the chains. Nothing to lose but the chains, but the chains. We move in silence like telepathy. My real freedom fighters on the higher. Stop raping us, stop killing us. How you love the black nation, but you not feeling us. We be fighting everybody's fight while you drilling us. Ain't your bitches or your hoes, get about your feelings, bruh. Yo, like a side of Shakur, I get hot at the core. This is my generation, we say not anymore. Ruling class, print the money, make a slave for it. My people wanna live in ways, tired of paying for their parasitical power trips around the world to expanding corporations with their grip and choke hold on the reservoir trees and the means of production. The black woman coming, we don't need an introduction. Yeah. When the last coming first, ain't nobody gon' thirst. Restore the equilibrium and never need a purse. Love them, feed them, lead them to freedom like Harriet. Then run them red lights with the global proletariat. Organize and rise, decolonize them lies. We qualified to ride, we working class, unite. We move in silence like telepathy. My real freedom fighters on a higher frequency. Nothing to lose
but the change. That is Kiana Selena with Unite, and you are live on Tribe Family Channels, the Book Club Hub Book Tour, with two of America's finest activists, barrier breakers. I have Mrs. Geraldine Hollis, one of the Tougaloo Nine, and Mr. Bernard N. Lee, who broke barriers in the educational system that helped separate school districts. And if you haven't been following their story, you have been missing it, but the archives are available at blogtalkradio.com/Gumbo for the Soul. Tribe Family Channel is a Gumbo for the Soul international family brand created by myself. I am Beverly Black. I'm the creator of the Book Club Hub Book Tour here on Tribe Family Channel. So we are about to hear some excerpts. We're down to our last half hour, and this is where our authors are going to bless the mic with a reading. So we're going to start with Queens First. Mrs. Geraldine Hollis, you have two publications. Please tell us your first one, what spawned it, if you haven't already prefaced it, and then read a excerpt for us, if you will.
Okay. I have already spoken a little bit about the event, but I would just like to read you a portion from one of the chapters, chapter 12, and it talks specifically about the feelings and the deeds. And it says, this is back to Mississippi, yes.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. So you're reading from Back to Mississippi by Geraldine Hollis.
Yes, this is Back to Mississippi by Geraldine Hollis. And this is the book that I came back with at the 50th anniversary. And it starts here, and it says, I knew that there may be bodily harm. I knew that there was the use of force in situations where sit-ins were done in other states. I knew that the police used dogs to control peaceful civil disobedience situations. I knew that the major news media had been contacted. The event was planned with the precision of a major event that would take place, and it really was. On March 27, 1961, I followed the instructions we were given. I knew exactly what I was assigned to do. I knew that I had a certain book title that would not be in the colored library when we first went there. I do not remember how we got to the two libraries, but I do remember being confronted by the detective. He asked me to leave. Here is where I knew that I had no fear. All of my life, I was confronted with opposition to be free to do what I saw others do, and this was basically whites. I was afraid for my situation, but the fear was gone, replaced with the determination to do this, to read in this library or suffer the consequences of my innate choice to do so. They took me away. They led me out of the building. I know that there was three of us, but I walked out with them, but the fear was gone.
Wow. Absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. And to stand in the face of such adversity and knowing that you are standing, fearlessly standing, that had to take a lot. Your heart had to be beating because there has to be this war going on where, like you said, you know all of the aforementioned dangers, and yet the fear was gone.
Yeah.
So that's remarkable. That's remarkable. That is remarkable. And where can our listeners pick up Back to Mississippi?
Back to Mississippi is in all of the online venues, specifically Amazon and Barnes & Noble. We had a problem. They thought that it was a textbook, but we've been trying to get past that. However, you can order the book from places if you can't find it online, and also if someone would like to have autographed copies, they can order from me. And basically that's through PayPal me. That's paypal.me@GeraldineHollis, and give me that information, and I can get a book out to them. And the March Memories retails for $15, and the Back to Mississippi for $20. But for $45, I will mail both of them autographed to the persons if they order them. Or either I will, they can just go to PayPal me and let me know what they would like to have. And I can get those to them if they don't want to just order them online.
And I think it would be such a wonderful gift to be able to get it directly from you and have them autographed. So I encourage our listeners to get your book directly from the authors. Support the authors. It takes a lot to pen the books, to get them from the pages in our mind to the pages in that book. So definitely want to support the authors. And for our listeners who have been tuning in and listening, this is the Book Club Hub Book Tour. That was Mrs. Geraldine Hollis, and she read from Back to Mississippi. So we are going to go over to Mr. Bernard N. Lee. And Mr. Lee, what book will you be reading from?
I'll be reading from A Look Back in Time, Memoir of a Military Kid in the 50s, Volume
Awesome.
1.
Awesome.
This story is from my 7th grade introduction to English. The next few minutes, my classmates stood and gave their versions of introductions. I was too embarrassed to turn around to face them, so I listened intently, hoping I would be able to place a voice with a face later. I was somewhat relieved when that exercise was over. The next thing the teacher did really piqued my interest. She asked the class if anyone could recite a list of prepositions from memory. I knew I could answer the question, so I raised my hand. The teacher selected a blonde-haired girl sitting in the front row, two seats down from me. I didn't get discouraged. My hand was still held high. A number of students stood, repeated prepositions they knew in answer to her question. I held my hand up, but for the next 5 minutes, the teacher ignored me. I counted about 8 students who volunteered to answer. Only 3 were able to recite more than 10 prepositions. When it appeared that all the volunteers to my rear had responded, the teacher looked at the front row for additional responses. My arm was getting tired, but my hand was still standing tall. I don't know what made the teacher finally decide to call on me. She may have been curious about what I wanted from her. Maybe she thought I had to go to the restroom. I couldn't read her mind, and I didn't try. I had my chance to show what I knew, and I wasn't going to turn it down. I rose and turned halfway towards the class before I could speak. The teacher informed me that I wasn't permitted to repeat any of the words that any of my classmates had already given. I suspect she thought that admonition would cause me to pause, possibly cut short the obvious interruption. I wasn't deterred at all. I knew I could recite prepositions. I had learned many years before. My sister and I had learned that a preposition was anything that a squirrel could do with a tree. He could go around the tree, over the tree, through the tree, under the tree, into the tree, and on and on. My mother had taught us that game. I loved winning. I was a competitor. I was ready for the teacher's challenge. I started slowly and continued naming prepositions one after the other. When I had reached preposition number 24, I noticed a scowl appear on the teacher's brow. She stood beside her desk and stared at me as I recited another 28 through 32. Then she abruptly interrupted me and told me to sit down. I had expected something a little less caustic. I didn't know why she seemed to be a little disturbed. What came next was shocking and totally unexpected. The teacher addressed the class and referred to my performance as an example of what you could expect from those people. I nearly fell out of my chair when I heard the words coming out of her mouth. "See, class," the teacher continued, "that's what's wrong with those people. They just don't know how to act. They are always showing off. That's why they will never amount to anything." That story occurred in the seventh grade. I was the only African-American in the class. It was my first English class and my introduction to English. I could have gotten upset, and my mother came to school a day later, met with the assistant principal, and pretty much straightened everything out. So I wasn't treated that way afterwards. I took it as a warning that this class was going to be difficult, and my response was to make certain I was always prepared for my English class. I was so prepared that I got A's in English, the seventh grade, the eighth grade, the ninth grade, the 10th grade. I was determined never to ever be embarrassed because I was not prepared or up to the task. Writing was not my strength. I'm actually a math and science major. I majored in engineering, electrical engineering. But I was able to write a book because of the background I believed I got in English by applying myself from a lesson that could have been embarrassing and could have destroyed a person who was less determined. But determination is something that if you stick with it, will never really let you down. And what you learn when you apply yourself and when you don't let anyone turn you around is that you can do it. And that's a story from a look back in time, memoir of a military kid in the 50s.
Wow, wow, wow. Absolutely extraordinary. And I am appalled. I almost fell out of my chair because the teacher is ostracizing the student, the adult in the room who is placed there to guide everyone through, has decided to pick on the one child that is different from the ethnicity of all of the rest of the children. And that is just absolutely appalling. But you cooked her goose. Okay, like you said, after about number 32, they sit down, Johnny, sit down. You know, that's enough out of you. Okay, smarty, arty. And now you done went on and became an engineer in science and could probably educate the world in STEM research. So I guess her goose and turkey is cooked at this point. I want to commend you for your accomplishments. Where can people buy your amazing book? And then I will let Mrs. Geraldine Hollis comment.
A Look Back in Time, Memoir of a Military Kid in the 50s, Volume 1 and Volume 2, is available on Amazon.com. And it's also available on my website, www.BernardLeeJr.com.
Amazing, amazing. Mrs. Geraldine Hollis, I would like to give you the opportunity to comment about Mr. Bernard Lee's book and his excerpt that he just read.
Excellent, excellent excerpt. I can understand how you must have felt, been there and done that, but I don't think that I would have been that good. And you really had me going there. I was saying to myself that, she's going to call on him. And I was saying to myself, oh, yes, he's going to get acknowledgement because as a teacher, that's what you do. You look for the best in students. And what you shared with me, it's like, oh, no, she didn't. But you know what? Your lesson to yourself in life is what everyone really should try to do. Build yourself up and be the best celebrant to yourself. And that's how we build self-esteem. It's not looking at what puts us down, but what helps us to move forward. And I really commend you, and I think that this is a great book. I'm going to have to really go into that. I would love to share that with others because so many people now need to have that type of motivation, and I do believe that I could get this for some of my nieces and nephews so that they can see that although they are doing a great job, that there's always a way to do even better. So thank you for sharing that with us, and thank you for your ideas in being the best that you can be. I really got the point that you said that you got all these A's in English and you were really a mathematician. And so you were working on some of your subjects that you had that you wasn't really feeling that positive about. But you showed that you can do all things.
Push me outside of my comfort zone.
Yes, out of your comfort zone. Yes. So really, that was just great. I could feel that one. Thank you so much. And congratulations, and I just wish you the very best. And I got your email, not your email, but your website. You shouldn't be able to forget that one, Bernard in LeeJr.com.
There's no N, it's just Bernard Lee Jr.
Okay, good. I'm glad I said that. Okay. LeeJr.com. Okay.
Well, that is amazing. Both of you have just been great guests here on the Book Club Hub. You have amazing stories. You have blessed the mic for Black History Month because one of the things is that we will never know where we're heading unless we know where we've been. Unless we know who we are and we know our history, we can never, ever fully fulfill our purpose and our destiny. I want to open up the phone lines because of your iconic presence. Perhaps someone on the phone lines that has raised their hand up would like to speak to you. So I'm going to open up the phone lines for area code 360. If you have a question or a comment, and actually that line just dropped, so they got a little shy here, but that's okay because this show is about being able to listen, learn, and extrapolate the rife, profound information and mantras. And definitely, like Mrs. Geraldine Hollis said, your ideology in what you have adapted, Mr. Bernard, in terms of your education, acquiescing the subjects that may not have been a breeze. Anyone can approach, you know, the easier subjects, but you went after the harder subjects, the more challenging academia, and you've come out very successful. So I commend you, Mr. Bernard Lee, and Mrs. Geraldine Hollis, I commend you as well, to stand in the face of adversity. That's what I really wanted to say to both of you, is that my takeaway from having this conversation and this wonderful listening to the dialogue between the two of you, my takeaway from this is that you have to have a strong countenance and a strong disposition and demeanor about yourself to stand in the face of adversity. And that would be how I would conclude this show. The level of strength and the activism, the breaking barriers, the strength that the two of you exhibited during a time when it's easy to be weak. It would be easy to be fearful and say, you know, I don't want this because something could happen to my family. It certainly begs to commend both of you, and I honor you for being part of the Black history that affords us the freedom and the privileges and the respect that we have and that we're continuing to fight for. So thank you both so very much being such esteemed guests here on the Book Club Hub Book Tour. It's been an honor, privilege, and a pleasure, and I will be returning back right here on the same Tribe Family channel, same Tribe Family station, Tuesday, March 6th, for another episode of the Book Club Hub, where we will have yet another round table of some amazing guests. So continue to follow us. Our studio is blogtalkradio.com/Gumbo for the Soul. I am the parent company of Tribe Family Channel at Gumbo for the Soul. You can visit us online at gumbofortheSoulInternational.com. Our website is currently being updated, but there's a little something to whet your palate. Also, follow Tribe Family Channel and connect with me on Facebook at www.facebook.com/Tribe Family Channel or on Twitter at Tribe Family US. Of course, you can email me if you have any interest in appearing on one of our shows. We have a plethora of shows, many subjects that you can partake in. Mrs. Geraldine Hollis has her own show, Voices of Wisdom. It airs on the first Thursday of the month. The Tougaloo 9 will be minus one that has gone on, and we recognize and ask for you to reign in paradise, let your light continue to shine. The eight remaining Tougaloo 9 prayerfully will be here on March 1st with Mrs. Geraldine Hollis. Moderating that show is going to be Mr. Mike O'Brien, and he wrote a book called, oh my gosh, it just escaped me.
We shall not. Be moved.
We shall not be moved. There you go. And that entails the Woolworth sit-in. So yet again, more activism, more breaking of the barriers that have tried to hold people down, and more standing in the face of adversity. Any final comments either of you, from either of you, would you like to have any final words?
Thank you. Thank you. And I really appreciate the Book Hub. This is my first time on the Book Hub, but I listened to a couple, and I really appreciate your offer to let the public know about all of the writers and writers, and I just think that it's great. So I love most of the things that you're doing. I have to hold my peace. I'm just a fan of yours.
Thank you. Such a blessing to us, Mrs. Geraldine Hollis. Not only do you have your own radio show here, but Mrs. Geraldine Hollis is a sponsor of a couple of shows here on Tribe Family Channel. So without all of you who support us and Mrs. Geraldine Hollis, your generous contribution, we would not be able to be here. So I want to thank you. And do you have any final words, Mr. Bernard Lee?
Well, yes. Thank you, Ms. Beverly Black, for hosting this show. Thank you so much for introducing me to Ms. Hollis. I really, really enjoyed sharing this time with her. I feel now that I have a better understanding of what occurred during that period of time, and I appreciate you sharing that with me and sharing that with your audience. A look back in time. It's a book that I believe will be helpful to younger people and to people who lived in the 50s and the 60s and remember those years. So thank you for letting me share a part of that.
Thank you.
Well, and thank you both so very, very much. It has been an extraordinary conversation to hear the dialogue between the two of you. To listen to an era of time where I was born in 1959, by the way. So when I hear 1955 and, you know, my jaw is dropping over here, I'm like, what? Wasn't even here then. Wasn't even thought of. And yet in 1955, you were doing amazing things, Mr. Bernard Lee. 1961, Mrs. Geraldine Hollis, the Tougaloo Nine sit-in, I was 2 years old. So needless to say that I definitely am honored to be afforded the benefits of the adversity that you stood in the face of and the barriers that you broke through. So I want to thank both of you. You have been amazing guests on the Book Club Hub, and I invite you back anytime to Tribe Family Channel. Have a blessed remainder of your week. And if anyone is so inclined, tune in tomorrow to Soul School Music with Marshall Thompson. He is the last man standing of the Shylights. Tomorrow is his retirement announcement broadcast. 60 years, going on 60 years in show business. And so we invite you for that special broadcast. And he will be honoring Aretha Franklin March 25th. That will be her 76th birthday right here on Tribe Family Channel. So be sure to tune in. There's a plethora of shows. The lineup is on blogtalkradio.com/Gumbo for the Soul. So follow our studio and stay connected. We're going to go back up with the drums of our ancestors. So keep your ear to the drums so that you don't miss the message. God bless. Have an amazing week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's my honor. Thank you. Take care now. Let's go on out here. This is Dennis Coffey. Scorpio is the title. This song was out when I was in the 7th grade. Here we go. Be blessed.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.